afternoon, everyone. My name is Magdalena, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Can you guys hear me okay? Yeah, okay, so I'm picking up, okay, a little bit. You know, I'm in Al-Anon, so I like to fix things. I want to thank Via for asking me to speak. It's always such a great honor to get asked to go anywhere. So thank you, Via. This has been one of the most wonderful conventions I have been to. So she's really bossy. In a very loving way. You know, she tells you what to do, and it's always welcome. So thank you for the opportunity of being of service. And I also like to thank my friend Alana for picking me up from the airport, and her husband, and who's a normie. He was really nice, and, you know, he was okay when I gave him a hug. He didn't say anything. So anyways, thank you, everybody. The flowers are just beautiful, beautiful, and also the great gift in my room, so thank you. I also want to thank my friends from the Seattle area who are here. Yay, thanks for being here. Great support. You know, you guys have heard me over the years, and you're still coming, so I'm grateful for your support. So, okay. So my home group is the Rent on Thursday Night. It's the oldest group in the state of Washington. And before Al-Anon was there, we were already there. So the story goes that, according to our history, 87 groups were registered, of the families of alcoholics were registered with Alcoholics Anonymous. And alcoholics didn't know what to do with us. So Bill, they gave this list of registered groups to Bill Wilson, and Bill said, went to his wife, and he's like, they don't qualify, you know, to be in AA. Can you start something with the families? And Lois said, well, Bill, I'm over 60 years old. I've been homeless for a long time. She didn't say thanks to your alcoholism, but, you know. And we finally have a home, Stepping Stones, and I love to work in the garden. I don't want to start a group. You know, but thank God that Lois loved the families of alcoholics, that she went in and made a decision to start the family group. So she and her friend Ann B wrote letters to all the 87 groups that were registered with AA and asked them if they would want to be part of the Al-Anon family group and accept the steps and traditions as part of the fellowship. And 56 of those groups responded, and my group is one of them. So we celebrated in June, last June, we celebrated 68 years, so yes. I'm from Ensenada, Baja California. It's right on the beach. It's a beautiful drinking town. Everybody gets drunk, everybody gets high. We have one of the most popular bars is Husson's, that has been there since the 1800s, so some of you might have visited, I don't know. But anyways, the first alcoholic in my life that I met was my father. My father is, he was not a nice alcoholic, you know. My dad and I never got along. My dad is about 5'4", 5'5", really short, real big belly, big head, really ugly. You know, my mom is tall, gorgeous, she was 5'11", light complexion, beautiful, and I really didn't know what she was doing with this ugly guy, you know. And I am the first, I'm the oldest of six girls. My dad always wanted a boy, and I was born, so he named me after his father. His name was Magdaleno, so they just changed the O to an A. And because my dad wanted a son, you know, he and I just never got along. My dad's alcoholism was that kind of alcoholic that was violent, and every morning he will, you know, tell me to get up, and he would call me Larguchona, which means something ugly and long. It really doesn't mean anything. I've always been tall and thin, you know, so he would say, Larguchona, go get me a bottle of tequila. And in Mexico, at that time, I'm not sure how it is today, but they used to sell alcohol to little kids. So I remember being 6, 7, 8 years old, going to the liquor store to get him a big bottle of tequila. And on my way back, I remember carrying this big bottle of tequila and thinking, my God, I can't remember the last time I had milk. All we eat is, at home is beans and tortillas. That's all we ate every day. My dad was a baker and we didn't even have bread in the house. So anyways, I would come home and tell him, well, here's your tequila. And I would tell him, by the way, I can't remember the last time I had milk. And all you do is just drink your tequila. So my dad was not happy about that, you know. And so he would pull out this skinny little leather belt that he had for a number of years. Oh my God, I always remember having this little skinny leather belt and just pull it out of his belt and of his pants and just hit me with the belt, just hit me. And I remember being this, you know, skinny little kid with, you know, putting and trying to protect myself. I remember putting my arms up like this so he would not hit me on the face, but I had belt marks all over my body, you know, and my legs. And I remember going to school like that. And I will approach the kids, wanting to play with kids, and kids can be rude, you know, when they're growing up. And so I wanted to go play with the kids, and the kids will tell me, no, we don't want to play with you. You look strange. And they would say, look at you, your dad beat you up again. And I could not hide those belt marks. How could I hide them? And then the kids would say, and then you smell like beans. And I did, because we didn't even have a toothbrush. We had no running water, nothing at home. And so I remember just looking at my sister, you know, who's here this week, and she was one of the popular kids, and the kids liked her, and I remember just following them. You know, and the kids just didn't want to play with me. So anyways, I felt the rejection really young in life. My mom just kept having kids, and I was just like, why is she having kids with this guy? He's so ugly, you know. But then, you know, back in the day, I'm not sure what the Pope says today, but if he said that if women took birth control pills, they will go to hell. So my mom did not want to go to hell, and so she just kept having kids. But, you know, she didn't realize that living with the ugly monster was already living in hell because he was just so ugly, you know. My dad also was this kind of alcoholic that he loved having a woman on the side, you know, and I really didn't know why they would pay attention to him because he was so ugly. But I heard later that alcoholics are good talkers, and my dad was a good talker, you know. He was able to convince them. So one day my dad came to my mom, and my mom was on her, I think she was in her middle to late 20s with five kids and a sixth grade education. And she my dad came to her and said, you know that I don't love you. You know I'm seeing somebody else. You know she's a lot younger than you are. So I want you to leave and take your five kids with you. And my mom, like I said, she was in her middle to late 20s with a sixth grade education. So she started looking for work, and nobody will hire her. You know, she used to wash clothes by hand for construction workers. She used to steal, her and, you know, the kids and all help my mom steal water from the park to be able to shower and wash clothes and have, you know, water for our basic necessities. And so she, with, you know, with the money that she earned by washing clothes by hand, that's how I used to eat, you know, from her earnings, not from my father. So I just hated my father. My father also told me every morning, you know, he would tell me, Larguchona, get up and sweep the floor. And I remember looking at him and saying, why, it's a dirt floor. You know, it didn't make sense to me, but I always needed to argue with him. I always felt that necessity to argue with him. I didn't know my dad was sick, because somebody who's in their right mind does not treat a child like worse than an animal, you know. But my dad was sick. Today I understand that, but back in the day I didn't. So my mom went to work in the U.S., and she went to work illegally, and she started sending money so we could eat a little better. But my dad's alcoholism progressed to the point that he stopped looking at us like we were his daughters and we were women. And so he started spying on me when I was getting undressed, and I wrote to my mom and said, Mom, this is what's going on. I knew something was going to happen. And so my mom, you know, had witnessed stuff in the past, and she said, well, you can come and work with me in the U.S., but you can't go to school. And I said, Mom, that's fine. I'm not learning anything anyways. I had stayed back in third grade 3 times because my dad, you know, told us every day, you know, that women should not go to school. Women should be selling food on the street. Every time a child was born, my dad would say, oh, another prostitute. One day I asked my mom, what's a prostitute, Mom? And she said, well, you know, when we go to the bar and wait for your dad to come out of the bar, you know, those women that are at the bar pulling guys in, those are prostitutes. And I remember looking at me and I don't look like them, you know, but I must be because my dad said. The kids in the neighborhood always call me names. You know, they told me that I look like a dog, and I remember barking myself in the mirror and saying, "Yeah, you look like a dog." I had this dog, when we live in Ensenada, and his lips and my lips kind of look alike. You know, so I thought I really look like a dog. And you know, thank God for Al-Anon that erases all the insanity out of our minds. I know, you know, today I understand that you know, without step two, asking God to return us to sanity, I don't know where I'll be. Because in Al-Anon I learned that in our One Day at a Time book says that when a person is calling you names, especially the alcoholic, is it's just a reflection of how that person feels. So somebody who thinks positive does not call another person negative names. So my dad felt like whatever he was calling me. So anyways, I told my mom, I'm not learning anything, Mom. I remember looking at the books and looking at the words and in the books, and the words would just dance. I just could not learn anything. When I remember reading, trying to read the school books, but I'd be thinking, am I gonna get beat up today? Do I have to go get water? Are we gonna have, you know, gas today? Sometimes we didn't have electricity. A lot of the times we didn't have electricity. So I just need not learn. So I told my mom, I'm not learning anything. And she said, well, yes, you can come. So I came like most Mexicans do to the U.S. I came illegally. I jumped the fence, you know, and went to work. And I went to work at this chicken farm. And these chicken farms, they have rows and rows and rows of chickens. And in every row, there's like these wire boxes, okay? And in the wire boxes, they have about 20 chickens. And under those wire boxes, there's a chicken poop. So when immigration went to take the illegal Mexicans back to Mexico, some of them will run up to the hill to hide, and some of us will hide in the chicken poop. And I was one of those who hid in the chicken poop. And I'm gonna tell you what it's like to be sitting in the chicken poop, because you probably haven't had that experience, you know. When you're sitting in the chicken poop, there's worms, there's bugs, and they just stick to your skin. I was 15 years old, and I had a lot of acne. And when I didn't hear any noise, I would come out of the chicken poop and try to dust myself off. But the chicken poop is creamy, and it just sticks to your skin. It's really hard to get out of it, get removed from your skin. And I remember being covered with this chicken poop and thinking, I'm just like this chicken poop. I'm nobody, you know? And all those tapes that my dad used to tell me were playing in my head. You know, you're stupid, you're too tall, you're too skinny, you're too dark, you're a prostitute, you should not be going to school. All those things were part of me. And thank God again for a program that accepts all of us just the way we are, because, you know, the steps, traditions, and concepts have now become part of me. And when those old tapes want to come and take over, I go, no, you know. I ask God to return me to sanity, and I remember where I'm at today. I am a child of God. And you know, he has put us all in a special place that is such a gift. So Anyway, so I went, one day I asked my mom, "Mom, can I go to school? I don't have any friends." And she said, "Yes, you can go to school." So I went to night school, and that's where I saw the most beautiful guy in the universe, you know? There he was. He was tall, thin, beautiful, long hair. And I saw him, and I just felt in love with him. You know, when this guy had beautiful long hair, and I looked at him, and I looked at me, and I said, "He'll never look at me." And I, those tapes again started playing on my head, and I remember, because he had such a long, beautiful hair, when he moved, the world moved with him. You know, he was just gorgeous. In Al-Anon, yeah, and I, although I feel so bad, in Al-Anon also says, on the courage to change, it says that anything we let go has our claw marks on it. So even though I felt so bad, I was not going to let him go that easily. So I started spying on him. You know, now I had this one friend. And you know, back in the day, it used to call spying. Today, it's called stalking. So it's against the law. So I started spying on him, and every time he went by, you know, I had this one friend, and I would throw my friend, and so he would think it was her, but, and then I would throw kisses at him. And then somehow he found out that it was me, and one day I was at the park with this one friend, and he called me over, and there he was with all of his friends. He had a lot of friends, and I go, "Oh my God, he knows I'm alive." And so I went up to, you know, after we introduced ourselves, he said, "Would you like to go to a concert with me tonight?" And I thought, I wonder what that is. And I said, "Sure, of course." And it was 1975, and Bad Company was playing in San Diego. So he came to pick me up, and he had this little Nova. And because he had a lot of friends, all of his friends were sitting in the back of the car. They will pile up on top of each other, you know. But I got to sit next to him, and oh, I was just in heavens, you know. They were drinking, which was normal for me because everybody drunk, right? And then they started, you know, and Alan and I learned also that we got to be honest. You know, when we take the inventory, we got to be honest. So I needed to remember that although life was hard at home, I had my grandparents. My grandparents just loved me. They told me every single day that every time they saw me, they said, "Mi negra." My grandma would call me "Mi negra," which is my black girl, because at one time before Washington, I used to be the darkest in the family. When I was telling a friend, it's like, "I'm embarrassed, I'm so white now. I want to go back to Mother Earth." The color of Mother Earth. But anyways, my grandparents just loved me, and I remember spending a lot of time with my grandparents, my grandma will make flour tortillas, and I will put butter on the flour tortilla and then just eat the tortilla, and then I will go next room where my grandfather was, and everybody talked about my grandfather being so smart. My grandfather said that he traveled all over the world, and he spoke several languages, and I remember sitting on my grandfather's laps, and he would read books to me, and then he would put the book down, and then while I was sitting on my grandfather's laps, I was helping him clean the seats out of the marijuana, and then I will help him roll the joints for him, you know. And then my grandfather would light up a joint and say, "Hear me, how you want to take a hit?" And then I would say, "Oh, Grandpa, no, that stinks." You know, so, and then my grandpa was so smart that he would start talking in Japanese and Chinese and all that, you know. You know, our denial is so thick that it took me, I think, 5 years in the program before I realized that my grandfather was high the whole time. You know, he was talking to me in Japanese and Chinese and... And then I also learned that marijuana makes people lazy, so he probably never went anywhere. You know, it was just, like, you know, but that was good times in my life. And so I'm sitting next to my husband now, or next to this guy that I'm in love with, and he doesn't know. And they start smoking marijuana, and the joint went in front of me. And then they say, you want to smoke? And then I said, oh, no, thank you. But in my head, I thought, you know, if you need help, I can roll them for you. Because by that time, I had years of experience. And so we dated for 2 years. His alcoholism progressed, where now he was using acid, and he was just out of control. He tried to kill me a couple of times because he was high on acid. And then I remember thinking, well, you know, while he's choking me, I'm thinking, all he needs is love, you know. When he grew up homeless on the streets in Mexico, so I said, he just needs a lot of love. So when we get married, I'm just going to love him enough that he's going to stop drinking. And I truly believe that. And I thought, okay, so when we get married, we're going to live in a nice house in Rancho Bernardo, which is higher class neighborhood in San Diego. And then we're going to play tennis in the weekends. And then we're going to have two lowriders park in the car, park in the driveway. Of course, none of that happened. I got pregnant and I told him, I'm a strong woman. You don't need to marry me. And he said, you're crazy. We're getting married. So we got married, and we had this tiny little kid. You know, she was so beautiful. I remember looking at my beautiful daughter. Her name is Mirabella, which means look at the beauty. And I remember looking at her, and she looked just like her dad. And I said, you know, this is the fruit of two people that love each other a lot. And here's the fruit, my daughter. And I was just so in love with my daughter. I remember looking at her and saying, Mija, you're so beautiful. You know, I'm going to love you and protect you so much that nobody's going to hurt you like I'm being hurt. And you can have everything I have, you know, everything that I could not have. And, you know, I really meant it. I love my daughter. But I didn't know that living with alcoholism, we become sick too. And soon I forgot to stop taking care of my daughter. And all my concentration was on what the alcoholic was doing, not doing, and how to prevent him from doing whatever he was about to do. He had a lot of friends, and he would not come home. And I remember calling the hospital, calling jail, calling his family, calling everybody. And when he didn't come home, I remember wearing something sexy, waiting for him. But by 2, 3, 4 in the morning, I was no longer feeling sexy. So he would come home. We always lived in these neighborhoods where there was a lot of crime. And so I remember he would come home and with his friends, and I would be waiting for him behind the door with a kitchen knife, you know, just waiting for him. And as soon as he would walk in, I wanted to attack him. And his friends would say, gosh, Magdalena, leave him alone. And then I would tell him, if you don't leave, I'm going to kill you too. So the friends would just leave. It's like, okay, we're friends, but not that good of a friends. You can have him, you know. So, you know, these were not very nice guys, but I just did not care. I had all this anger inside of me. And so then the next day I will apologize. And that was another excuse for him to continue to drink. So, and we did this for years. I decided that I was, you know, sometimes I cook, I didn't cook. I beat him up, I didn't beat him up. I cleaned the house, not cleaned the house, nothing. He continued to drink, nothing worked. And so I decided that I'm gonna have a boy, and this time he's gonna stop drinking. And then, I had a boy, and his name is Carlos. And I remember looking at my little boy and making the same promise. And of course, that did not work. My husband's alcoholism progressed to where he was now using heroin. He started shoplifting. I started shoplifting with him because, after all, he needed a supportive wife. And so it was just crazy. Life continued to get worse. And one day, I just didn't know the way out. I didn't know. I knew there was help for the alcoholic, but I had never heard anything about that for the friends and families of alcoholics. And one day, I got on the car. I was in a car, And I knew that if we continue in this lifestyle, by this time my sisters were now in the U.S., some of them were married to alcoholics who were beating them up, some of them had become gang members. My grandfather and my husband were getting high together. My mom and her boyfriend were now selling heroin to my husband. And it was just, I just didn't know what else to do. I was so sad, so depressed and lonely, and I just didn't know what to do, and I just wanted to die. I remember going as a child, I remember going to church and getting on my knees and talking to the priest, and the priest would say, well, you just need to pray this thing and pray this other thing, and that did not help me. That did not help me. I felt worse after going to church, and that's just my experience, okay? I don't know others, but that was my experience. I also thought about, well, if I go to counselors, maybe that will help. But I thought people that went to counselors were those who had boogers coming out of their nose and saliva. And I look at myself in the mirror, there was a lot of things wrong with me, but no liquids coming out of my face, so I didn't belong there either. So one day I got in the car and I put my two kids in the car and I just wanted to die. And I started driving. I was driving 100 miles an hour and I just wanted to die, and my kids took die with me, because I knew that if we continued the lifestyle, I knew that my kids were gonna end up in prison, get shot by a gang member or end up with heroin. And I just, you know, everybody was dropping dead in those years, I remember. And so I got in the car and I started driving, and I was just out of control, out of desperation, and I screamed the scream that many of us do. If there's a God up there, please help me stop, because I just wanted to die. And today I understand that when we ask God for help, God listens. It might take him a month, it might take him a year, but God listens. And God listened to me that one day, and shortly after, my husband went in front of the judge, and the judge asked him if he wanted to go to treatment or prison, and he chose treatment. So he went to treatment, and that's when I was introduced to Al-Anon. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I remember sitting there and just looking at everybody, and everybody looked so happy. And they had the steps, traditions, and concepts on the walls, the slogans, everything was just so beautiful. But you know, they asked me if I wanted to share, and I still had this false pride that I'm better than. You know, I started thinking, you know, I'm married to this dude that goes to prison, you know, he's full of tattoos, my sisters have nice low riders, everything's fine, you know, this false pride that I had nothing. Maybe they had it, I had nothing, I was empty inside. And so they asked me if I wanted to share, and I said, well, I don't think I belong here, because see, my husband's not an alcoholic, he's an addict. And I said that because although I thought addicts were higher class than the alcoholic. And I didn't want them to know. I didn't want to know that I was married to somebody just like my dad. So anyways, this really nice lady tapped me on the shoulder. She said, dear, keep coming back. And I didn't come back for another 6 months. My husband got out of treatment, started drinking again. We moved to Tijuana, and I said, okay, this is how, you know, the problem is that your friends, you're hanging out with your friends. We'll move to Tijuana, and then you're gonna be away from your friends, and we're gonna be okay. But as you guys know, he found new connections, and there I was at home again. And I'm still illegal. I'm crossing the border every single day with my two kids. I will get up at 4 in the morning, put my kids in the trunk of the car, and cross the border. And I had learned a little bit of English where I could say that I was a U.S. citizen. Sometimes they let me go, sometimes they did not. And so I did this for 6 months. And one day, my husband was drunk again, and so I decided, okay, I'm going to take karate classes because he needs a stronger message. So I went and took karate classes. I thought I had gained some sort of serenity that he would come home, and instead of me waiting by the door, I would wait in bed. And then as soon as he walked into the bedroom, I would jump out of bed and go, ha, 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 you know. tried to cut him in pieces, and that didn't work. You know, he continued to drink. And one day I was driving this, I used to drive like 100, maybe 60 miles a day to keep him away from his friends. And one day I remember looking at him, and he was passed out on something. And that day it is like I woke up of a nightmare. I remember looking in the back seat of the car, and there was two kids. And my kids, you know, they were just sitting there like zombies. My kids were so skinny. Their hair was on their face, and they had the saddest look on their face. And the upholstery of the car had been teared down. And I said, it's like I woke up and I go, what happened? How did I get here? I looked at my kids and I said, how did I get here? I made a promise to love them. My kids did not play. My kid, I became vegetarian when I was 11 years old because I used to do yoga. The kids were born vegetarian. There's not a lot of food sometimes in Mexico, especially when you're driving all the time. So my kids had hardly anything to eat. And there's no milk, there's no running water. There was nothing in Mexico at that time. And so that day, Al-Anon came back to my mind because that's the only thing that had given me some hope in my heart. And so that day I decided that I was gonna let go. And then I remember the only two things that stayed in my mind on that day is keep coming back and first things first. And I looked at my kids and my kids were first. And that day I made a decision to move back to the States and go back to Al-Anon, and my husband went to prison. He went to prison for about a year. And I went back to Al-Anon, and this time I was ready to do anything. The program told me to do anything because I had felt hope. That's the only place that I felt hope. So I went back to Al-Anon, and I heard, get a sponsor, work the steps, keep coming back, read the literature, stay connected, and do service. And so I didn't speak the language. I didn't speak English. There was no Spanish meetings at that time. But I was gifted with the gift of desperation because I was willing to do anything. And I knew that Alan would help me get better. And so I went to my second meeting and I heard that. And I remember walking into the room, and this was in 1984. It was in March, and I had this big jacket. I was shaking. I was so ashamed of everything that I had done, not treating my kids right, you know, the shoplifting, not being a good mother, good daughter, oh, whatever. And I sat there. I had holes on my jeans, long hair, and I remember the first miracle happened. I sat there. It was in everything in this world happens for a reason, and I truly believe that. So I got there early, and it was a large meeting in a small room. So I got there early, and I sat next in the couch, and two people sat next to me. And in my heart, you know, I used to shake all the time. All the time I was shaking. I was so cold, so lonely that, you know, the coldness that it's in your heart and it's hard to feel. I mean, there's not enough blankets in the world to cover the loneliness and the coldness that is in your heart. And so I sat next in the middle, two people sat next to me, and their warmth started warming my arms, and their positive energy or love, whatever you want to call it, touched my heart, and I stopped shaking. I stopped shaking. And so I continued to come, and on my second or third meeting, I went up to this man and I asked him if he will be my sponsor. And I asked Ralph if he will be my sponsor, because every time somebody shares, Ralph will acknowledge the person. And you know, our literature says that when we live in alcoholic homes, we speak a different language. And I remember trying to communicate with my husband, and he would not listen. So I would get louder, and then he would get louder. And so we speak a different language. I remember him laughing with his friends. I'm like, what are they laughing about? I don't get it. I just don't get it. And so But in Alan and I did. And so after the meeting, I went up to Ralph and I, and with my little English that I knew, I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And like I said, I had holes on my jeans, and my husband used to cut my hair when he was drunk, because I couldn't afford a hairdresser. He's like, I got it for you. And so that's how I came to Al-Anon, and I remember going to Ralph and said, will you be my sponsor? And Ralph looked at me. You know, in the program we said, when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon always be there, and let it begin with me. And Ralph was there for me. And I didn't know Ralph was from England. And Ralph had this strong English accent. I'm from Mexico, I can't speak the language. But Ralph looked at me and he said, we'll give it a try. And Ralph and I started getting together every week at the park. And I remember started writing about the steps using the dictionary. And I remember, you know, just translating every word, but sometimes it didn't make sense. And Ralph said, what is this? And then I would try to explain the best I could. And so, you know, we started working the steps. Ralph told me, Magdalena, you are no less than anybody. You're equals to everybody. God did not make any of his kids to be less important. God loves you just the way you are, so you need to stop calling yourself names. And then we got to, you know, all the steps. On step three, I remember I was getting so excited by learning. I went to meetings every single day. I started meetings in Spanish because I thought, okay, this is the solution to all my family's problems. You know, so I went and I started meeting in Spanish, and so hoping that my family will come, but none of them came, you know. Other people came, and I remember picking up people, taking them to the meetings. Ralph used to come with me to help me start the meetings, and I started Alateen. I was just so, so busy. Then we got to the step four, and Ross and Magdalena, I told them about everything that was wrong with me, and I also told them a couple of good things about me and on my four-step inventory, and he said, you need to stop treating yourself that way. He said, see that bird up there? And it was a crow, and I said, yes. He's like, what do you think of that bird? I go, well, it's beautiful. It's very black, you know. It's black, it's shiny. He's like, do you think the bird gets up in the morning and looks at itself in the mirror and says, you're so dark? You know, feathers are out of place. One leg is longer than the other. He's like, no. The bird gets up in the morning and does God's will. That's what we do. The bird gets up, go looks for food for the bird, for his kids, comes home and feeds the kids. It's like, that's what we do. We do God's will. It's life on life's terms, not on Magdalena's terms. So I because I opened an Alateen meeting, my kids started going to Alateen meeting, my husband got out of prison, and he comes over one day and he says, well, if you don't do A, B, and C, I'm going to go out and get drunk. And then, you know, and Alan and I had learned that. I remember calling Ralph and saying, Ralph, my kids are crying. And he said, if your kids are crying, there's a reason, Magdalena, you need to listen to them. And so I took the kids to Alateen, so now they were familiar with the program. And I told them, if I'm screaming, please let me know, because I don't know. And I can't tell. And they would say, Mom, you're screaming. I'm like, oh, okay. So I would learn to lower my voice and speak with them. Alan and also says that we treat everyone with courtesy and respect. So I started treating my kids with courtesy and respect. And Alan and I learned, you know, my friends in the program said, okay, so when you pick up your kids from the daycare program, you take them home, you feed them, you take them for a walk, And listen to your kids. Just listen to what the kids have to say because they have their own story. And so I started listening to my kids, and they just adore their father. They adore their father intuitively. They knew that there was something wrong with their father, and they just adore him the way he was. It didn't matter that he was in prison. My kids just loved their father. They just didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, so I just, and I would listen to them. They said, awesome. Then take him home, help him with their homework, give him a bath, put him in bed, read something to them, and then you put yourself in bed and read something, because in the Just for Today pamphlet, it says, just for today, I will read something that will strengthen my mind. I will not be a mental loafer. So that's what I was doing when my husband comes into the room and says, if you don't do A, B, and C, I'm gonna go out and get drunk. And so I said, well, just make sure you lock the door on your way out. So I had learned that detachment with love. Finally, I knew that I could not fix him. I could not cure him. And so instead of going out to get drunk, he went to an AA meeting, and today he's been sober for 36 years. And I'm totally crazy. Thank you. It was 1990, and the world was gathering together in Seattle. Al-Anon with AA participation, AA with Al-Anon Participation Convention, the international convention, and I told my husband, you know, why can't we go? Everybody's going. You know what happens when we stop bailing out the alcoholic out of jail? There's money. Yeah, so we had a home, a trailer, a boat, cars, anything we always wanted, and everything we had. And so we came to Seattle, and we just felt in love with the city. You know, it's so green, so beautiful, so many rivers, and we had never seen that. And I remember going for a run. I have always enjoyed exercising, and going for a run and telling God, why are you so beautiful to me? And as I was running, I found this heart that says, I love you. And it was in July, and I picked up the heart, and I said, God loves me. And so I still have that heart. So anyways, after that convention, I told my husband, why can't we move here? It's so beautiful. And he said, we can move. There's nothing holding us. Wherever we go, there's our family of recovery. And so in 1990, we sold everything and moved to Seattle. And we moved into this tiny little one-bedroom apartment. And the kids thought that they were camping every night because it was so great. And I went to the local intergroup office, and I asked him if I could be of service. I said, do you have anything for me to do? Because I know I can't keep it unless I give it away. And they said, well, just keep coming back so we can get to know you better. And after a while, they gave me the great honor to be the Latin coordinator for the Seattle intergroup office. And now I was, you know, I didn't know there was no Spanish meetings in Al-Anon Spanish, so I started Spanish meetings. There was the AA in Spanish had a little bit of trouble, so they used to just meet once a week in Seattle. That's it. And my husband said, there's got to be more alcoholics than me. So he went to look for other people, and he started several AA meetings in Spanish. And now we're all busy, right? Kids are in Alatin. My daughter's speaking everywhere. She's speaking in Alaska. She's speaking in all the local schools. And then something changed. You know, I'm working at a Denny's restaurant as a waitress. My husband used to clean the elevators. He used to make elevators in San Diego area. Now he's cleaning the elevators at the airport. But you know, we were happy. It's money is good energy, but it's not everything. It's not everything. I told Ralph, Ralph, what do you think if I move? And he said, Magdalena, if you don't move, you will never find out. You will always wander. So go with what your heart tells you. And so anyways, our daughter started looking different. Although she was very active in Alatin, she started looking different. She will come home with black marks on her eyes and bruises on her skin, and we just didn't know what was going on, and we found out that she was drinking. And I was so angry. I was so angry. I remember screaming at the God of my understanding, saying, how dare you give me an alcoholic daughter after all the service work I have done? So I called Rob and I said, Rob, my daughter is drinking. And Rob said, you know, Magdalena, God loves alcoholics too. And so he said, I think God wants your daughter to learn something. And so that's when our daughter's journey began, in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment. And you know, our kids are so smart. Kids that have grown in the program are so smart. They know all the language. You know, they know the language of love. So she was manipulating the counselors and hurting herself at the same time because she was talking to them the language of love. And so she would be in and out of treatment. And every time she came home, you know, she would go out again. And one day she came home and told our son, if you don't drink with me, you're not a man. So she was affecting that unity of the home, okay? Tradition one says that if we don't unite our forces, we die. And so our daughter and my husband and I, we started, you know, arguing because we were in pain, not because we blame anybody, we were just in pain. And in Alan and I learned that if I put my kids in the hands of God, God can take care of them. Before they were my kids, they were God's kids. Today, I believe the God of the who's the creator of the universe has all powers. He's got all powers. Every wave that comes out of the ocean, every star in the sky, everything in the universe works exactly the way it's supposed to. And if that, you know, if my understanding, the creator of the universe has so much power, why can't he take care of my daughter? You know, why can't he take care of my daughter? And so my husband and I talked and made a decision that to ask her to leave because we placed her in the hands of God. And when they're in the hands of God, they have everything. I knew, you know, Seattle gets cold, and I knew that she will have blankets, food, and everything. And once in a while, she would come home and say, Mom, I need help. And I would say, no, mija, you go to treatment, you go to AA, get a sponsor, work the steps, and you're gonna be okay. Because I trust Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that this program is created by God. And then one day she came home and said, you know, she got close to me and said, Mom, don't you understand I can't stop drinking? And my daughter's breath smelled just like my dad's breath, you know, that old stale alcohol. And I said, no, mija, I don't understand. And because see, I've never been drunk in my life. I've never been high. I don't understand the power of the disease of alcoholism, you know, when they can't stop drinking. And so I understand the Al-Anon part, but not the alcoholic part. But you guys do, and I trusted that you could help her. And so one more time, my husband and I decided to take her to treatment. We took her to Spokane on a Thanksgiving weekend, which was a snowy way over. And one more time, we put our daughter in a blanket. We wrapped her in a blanket, and we took her to this treatment center. And at the treatment center, they took her to Native American meetings. At the Native American meetings, they needed a coffee person. Mirabella, growing up in the program, she knows everything about service. So she became the coffee person, and today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, she's been sober for 36 years. I'm sorry, 26 years. And I'm just so grateful. She got married to the guy of her dreams. You know, they were both sober. They had a beautiful daughter. And unfortunately, her husband relapsed after 2 years. And she told her, you know, I love you, but I love my sobriety and my daughter more. And she walked out, just like that, you know. She did not need to take karate classes or bail him out of jail. Nothing, they're so smart. Today, she remarried, and she has two more kids. So she has three kids, and my daughter, she's just so beautiful, you know. She's sometimes she walks and butterflies follow her. Other times it's like, oh my God, who is that child? But, you know, she's doing the best she can. Our son, after 10 years of Alateen, he said, Mom, I'm normal. I don't need to go anywhere. I think I'm cured now. And so I said, that's fine. You've been in the program for a while. That's good. He had this, but he's grown with the program, so he knows all the principles. And one day, when he was a teenager, he had a girlfriend, and they adopted a cat. And when they broke up, my son gained custody of the cat and brought the cat home. I hate cats. And one day I was having an Al-Anon relapse. You know, we get those often. I was not having a good day, so I was spying on his room, you know, looking to see what he was doing. And this kid is very responsible. He's doing well in school. He has a job. You know, his room is clean for most of the time. He participates in school. He's doing good. But I'm having an Al-Anon problem. You know, I'm looking for a problem. I'm looking for a fight. So I look in his room, and I see that it's a mess. You know, tradition 10 says that we don't get into controversies. We don't get into outside issues to avoid controversies. His room is an outside issue. You know, it's his room. And so I looked and I saw that it was messy, and I wrote him a note saying, if you don't clean your room, I'm gonna throw your cat away. And so, and then he wrote me a nasty note back saying, Mom, I'm cleaning my room one day at a time. So I'm not all that way done yet. He put that triangle with the circle, he put AA Allen on, keep coming back, it works. And in Spanish, P.S., leave my cat alone. Yeah. So when he got when he graduated high school, went to the university, he left the cat home, you know. But I introduced him to the outside world, and he became a happy, joyous, and free cat. You know? He was not happy. Today, he's this great kid that has a great job. You know, he travels all over the world, not because of his job, but because he just loves life. He got married last year, it's been a year, and he's just this happy kid. Every Wednesday, we have family dinner, and we gather together. When I was working at Denny's restaurant, one day I came home and I worked a graveyard shift so I could be there for my kids in the morning. And one day I got on my knees and I told God, God, how much longer do I need to be doing this kind of jobs? Because I was full of grief. And I remember Ralph telling me, Magdalena, without an education, you're not gonna do anything in life. And I said, but Ralph, remember, I can't learn. And he said, yes, you can. You need to go back to school. So I went back to school because my sponsor said I needed to go back. And in 1998, 99, I graduated with a four-year college degree because my sponsor told me to. Today, I work for the state of Washington as a parole officer. I send people to treatment. And I send them to AA, you know. If they get drunk, I have no problem taking them to jail, you know. Sometimes people need to go there. The people that I supervise are people that have problems and become violent. And so my job is dangerous. Many of the times, all the time, every week we go out and look for them when they don't report. We just go visit them. They're usually alcoholics for some reason. They like to live in dark places. You know, everything's dark. And they like to hide their weapons and alcohol. And my job is to make sure that they don't have any weapons or alcohol or drugs. And so we go in the house and take that away from them, and they don't like it. You know, so one day I called Ralph and I said, Ralph, my job is dangerous. There's an opportunity for me to be armed, but I don't know, I haven't taken it because I don't know if I can pass a psychological evaluation because I'm kind of crazy. And Ralph said, well, Magdalena, if God wants you to be armed, you will. So you'll pass the test. So today I'm an armed officer. I call my sisters and I go, guess what? I have a gun. And they were so concerned for my husband. They did not recover, you know. Today, Carlos and I have been married for 42 years, and it's thanks to all of you. Thank you. I continue in service, and I became the delegate for the state of Washington. I just love Alan, and I love everything that I have done in life. Today I have a good relationship with my family. I have a good relationship with my mom. You know, even though my mom and my family have not been gifted with this gift of desperation, but you know, my job is, but I've been gifted and I have a program, and my job is to be the best daughter I can ever be. I call my mom once a week and I tell her, you know, I just say hi and see how she's doing. And of course, you know, she tells me about movie stars and gossip about the family. And I just listen and I go, okay, mom, I'll call you later. You know, I accept her just the way she is because that's the way she is, you know. There's nothing I can do to change her. And she's happy the way she is, or she might not be. It's her choice. In November last year, she turned 80 years old, and I asked her, Mom, would you like to go somewhere? Let's go somewhere, all the sisters. And first she said no. And then later on she said, I want to go. And the prices had gone up. You know, at that time, I was like, oh my gosh. You know, so, but, and so her dream was to go to Florida. And so I took her to Florida for her 80th birthday. And you know, my mom loves the ocean. And I remember, and so I took her to the ocean and she was like a little kid playing with the waves. You know, my mom is so strong. She never asks anybody for anything. And one thing that she asked, my job is to do it, you know, because everything, you know, that she did for us when we were growing up. And so my dad died, but before he died, I was, one day I was in Southern California, I spoke there, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna go see my dad, okay? I think I'm ready. I finally had understood that he was sick. You know, like I said, a normal person does not treat their kids the way he treated me. He was just not in the right mind. And so I thought, you know, I'm gonna go see him. He's my dad. So I went to see him and I talked to him. You know, the big ugly monster that he was, he had shrunk into a small man who had urinated on himself, you know, and he was drunk. And so I went and after a little bit I talked to him and as I was leaving, I gave him a hug and I said, Dad, I love you. And I surprised myself because I didn't know where that came from. It was not planned to tell him that. But I said, Dad, I love you. And I gave him a hug. And then I got in the car and my dad, I looked back and my dad was crying. And he called me back. He waved back to call me. So I got off the car and I went and he said, thank you for forgiving me. And he gave me another hug. You know, my dad was sick. All this time, you know, he was sick. And who am I to judge the children of God, including our alcoholic loved ones? So I have today, I'm just gonna close with this little thing, that story that I always close. Ralph was my sponsor for 35 years and he died last April. You know, he dedicated 35 years of his life to help me. And I miss him all the time, but you know, we move on. I truly believe on sponsorship. And after 2 weeks, I went and I asked a friend if she would be my sponsor because I need help. I need help. Sometimes I'm angry. It's like, why am I angry? I have everything I always dream of. Everything I wanted in life, I have. I have so much joy. And so I call her. It's like, oh, that's normal. You know, so I need that. So anyways, today I have a new sponsor, but I still am connected with my sponsor's wife, and I go see her in Nevada once a month because she's not doing well. So when I was a little girl, I remember going to the beach, and I just love that ocean. And I remember going to the beach, and that's the playground for kids or for anybody that wants it. But I had open wounds in my skin. And I remember going, and you know when you get in the salt water, the open wounds hurt. It hurts, the salt hurts your skin. And I remember going under the wave and hoping that I would come out on the other side where there was people that loved each other, that they were happy, that they understood each other, and there was no more pain, you know. Or if there was pain, it would be manageable. But I will come out of the other side of the wave, and life was the same. Today, I feel that I have gone under the wave, and I have found all of you. Thank you so much for my life, and God bless you.
Magdalena, we want to thank you.